come to order. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3052. Paul?
Let's start from you.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3052, you had a somewhat truncated hearing on the Dash 3 amendments, which do completely change the bill. And what they do is establish in law an assessment district that a county can form, and then it goes through and details how that can be formed. The purpose of the district would be provide improvements in operations related to law enforcement or public safety. And you just began to hear from the county, particularly from Clackamas County, who was developing this idea.
Thank you. Is there someone here from Clackamas County who wants to be heard? I think there is, but they may be in the hall.
Dexter's here.
David Barron.
Dexter's here, yeah. And would someone get the door?
Yes, there's David.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, Dexter Johnson from Clackamas County. At the moment,
here's David.
I think David's right
here. Is he coming? There he is.
Caught us a bit. By surprise.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm David Barenberg, and I'm representing Clackamas County. And with me is Dexter Johnson, also from Clackamas County and formerly from from Legislative Council. We're here today to just continue the public hearing on a new concept, which was the County Assessment District, which is before you as a Dash 3 amendment as a gut and stuff of HB 3052. The idea here, as you heard from testimony last week, was that there are significant needs in law enforcement at the county level that cry out for additional fundraising, and I know it's very hackneyed, and I was told I probably shouldn't use the term, but I will, tools for trying to address some of the issues that are before us. This idea would allow a county commission to develop a plan that could be for capital and operations, or just operations, of a law enforcement related issue for a district that they determine, the size of which they determine. Once the county would adopt the plan, and it could be for something like a sheriff's substation with enhanced patrol and for an area, they could then assess a fee that would be placed on the property tax bills. It would be an assessment on property, but not an ad valorem property tax. So, for example, it could be a fee on categories of property, a $10 on residential, $20 on industrial, $30 on commercial, something like that, that would pay for the plan that was adopted by the county commission. The plan adopted by the county commission could be referred by 10% of the voters in the district or 100 signatures, whichever is less. So there's a ample opportunity to put this before the people. There is a real onus on the county in moving this to make sure that all parties are consulted and ducks are in a row. And that would then allow them to move forward. One of the tools, ways that this tool could be useful in terms of counties that are facing severe revenue drops if the axe ever does fall, we hope that it doesn't, on the county timber money or in the federal timber money, it would allow a county to take steps to try to enhance and support its law enforcement fairly quickly in that case. So we put forward this idea. It's a new idea late in the process. We've been talking with many legislators, members of the committees, and other constituency groups have had a lot of input. We believe that it has potential. We believe that we really do need additional tools. And at the moment, we're still working with other partners and other parties trying to respond to some of the issues and concerns. And you know, today would ask just for some feedback from the committee, and we would intend to go out and continue to work on this concept with the other parties at this time. Dexter Johnson is much more expert in the specific operations and of the legislation, and the two of us are happy to answer any questions that the committee may have, and look forward to receiving some input and working with you as we go forward into the future.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, let me just follow up on one point about how this works. It is not a permanent kind of device. It is something where at the outset, when you create one of these districts, you, the governing body of the district, drafts a plan that explains what the purpose, how the funds will be used, what the purpose is, what improvements will be funded through the assessment, and the methodology for establishing the assessment. That plan is a measure that can be referred can be referred by the governing body or by the public if they choose. And that plan must, under the terms of the amendment, contain a stated duration at which point in time it will end.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add one more item, too, is one of the beauty of this tool is that it allows for a county to package a capital improvement with the operating costs and revenue, so it's can assure that it's a very uniform process for doing a capital improvement and being able then to operate it. So right now there are the tools for doing capital improvements, for doing operating levies, but this would bring together that into one option that a county would have.
Thank you. Questions, comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Volson.
I've talked with David and Dexter. I've talked with several different sheriffs around the state. And I wish we should have probably had a little bit of conversation before this a little bit more. It didn't work out. Never the sheriffs are not in favor of this because of the commissioners being able to just move right in with the way this is designed to do this, even though you have that 90-day window period for, 100 signatures is what we've talked about for contesting the movement with this, any type of plan with this. Of the sheriffs that I've talked to, they would prefer that it be, at least they're not feeling like it's really right up front with everything, and that the commissioners could just go ahead and sweep right in and do what they need to do for their plans and everything. They would prefer that it be right up front, where the voters make that decision at the very beginning. I'm just curious your thoughts with that.
Representative Olson, Representative Olson, we've had a lot of discussions, the sheriff from the county's had a lot of discussions, too, with law enforcement and other sheriffs, and their opinions all over the board. And that's and the statement I made at the beginning, talking about needing to work with other parties and trying to engage more with other parties, that's what we're currently trying to do, and appreciate the conversations that you've had, and we've had several also, and we would like to move forward and try to work with them to address the concerns. So very much appreciate the work you've done and talking to folks.
Okay. Mr.
Yes, please. Yes.
I don't want to walk away from our conversation or leave it not with the understanding that there hasn't been some sheriffs too that are in favor of it, because there has been that I've had discussion with. Where we left off back on, last week regarding testimony, and actually, Dexter, I think you were trying to answer the question, but the question that I had, and because of the time crunch that we were in, I don't think we really got to explore it a whole lot. What I'm interested in to kind of go after is we heard discussion from John Marti regarding the short term as well as the possibility of a permanent commitment with it. If this happens to be a situation where you're needing to build a jail, a correctional facility, and you're having to go out for the entire county. How do you see that working?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, you could establish a district that applies to the entire county. And as part of your plan, actually, let me address both of your questions here, because I think it's as drafted, there is a lot of notice and process that must occur up front before anything actually happens, mainly involving the adoption of a plan that sets forth exactly what the assessment district is going to do and the methodology for establishing assessments and what the revenues will be used for and the duration of the plan. I think responding to your second question, an assessment district could be established countywide, and it would not be able to go on permanently, but you could, if you were to, for example, use it for a jail facility, you could provide for the assessment district to be in existence for the duration of the bonding requirements for building the facility, plus the useful life of the facility for purposes of operating it. So that's not that's a long commitment, maybe 50 years, something like that. But it is not. This proposal would not permit you to have an indefinite commitment.
Okay. Thank you.
Looking at it from the other end, you could build a relatively small district for the purpose of a particular piece of construction. I mean, the thing that occurred to me, for example, might be a breakdown of a county road that along which there are a number of houses and businesses and it needed repair, maintenance, or maybe an upgrade, and you didn't have the funds for it in the county road fund. The way this reads to me, it looks as though you could establish a district like that along that road, around, you know, on the property surrounding that road, and finance the repairs that way and maintain the district as long as it took to pay for it. I don't know if that's something you contemplated with this bill, but it looks like it could be done with a bill like this.
Mr. Chair, a couple of points on that. Certainly this is a flexible concept so that you could create a very small, geographically limited district for very narrow purposes. Right now, in existing law, there is a road districts. There are some limitations on them, but assuming you could use those limitations in terms of population and the like don't apply, you could use a structure like that right now in existing law. And this concept just takes that, gives a little bit more flexibility, but it is as drafted for public safety and law enforcement purposes. And I know you could probably get into an argument about whether road construction is public safety or not, and in certain circumstances it might be. But I think that would be your main hurdle with this concept, but it's not. It's really largely based on the road assessment district concept.
Thank you. And of course, page 1, line 15 mm-hmm. deals with exactly the issue you raised, and I had missed that. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this similar then to the road construction districts that we have in southeastern Oregon, which now no counties are qualified to use those anymore? Would this follow along the same lines where the county commission would define the boundaries and would then, after identifying the boundaries, then go ahead and have established it and then have the folks vote on a tax base for their particular improvement? Tell me, I need to know something about the mechanism, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it is similar, but not. I'm not sure I actually agree with your characterization of the way the current road districts work there. This is not a traditional property tax, and therefore there isn't all of the Measure 50 issues that you get into. This is a
flat fee assessment type approach. Now, I believe, just off the top of my head, that road districts are also that way.
Mr. Chair, they are that way, and they call it an assessment. They don't call it a tax, but it's based upon, I think it's based upon the RMV, but it could be upon the AV, I don't know. Okay.
That's where, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's where you get into the, that's what a traditional property tax is, whether it's based on assessed value or real market value. It's a measure of value that is what determines how much you owe as a property owner. And this expressly does not apply to those kind of charges, the traditional property taxes, because Measure 50 would say you can't do that.
So this is outside of Measure 50, Mr. Chair?
You're getting a nod from one of the experts.
Yes, it is outside of Measure 50. It is. Measure 5 is a different, that's the $10 cap in this case. That's a different animal. That has an extremely broad definition in the Constitution of tax, and this would be fall within that definition. So it is subject to the $10 limit on real market value. But it is not a, you don't have to deal with the permanent rates and all of that stuff.
So I'm still concerned, Mr. Chair, about the mechanism. How is it imposed if we use your example, you know, the people that live within these four sides of the road, how is it imposed then upon those folks? What's the mechanism?
The mechanism, Representative Butler, is with the adoption by the governing body at the beginning, at the outset, of a plan that says, that sets forth the methodology. And what I mean by that is it will say, okay, this particular improvement, for example, will benefit all real property, and for residential property, there will be one assessment. For industrial property, there will be a different assessment. For commercial property, there will be a different assessment. And they can break that down a little bit further. Just can't go to a measure of value for what the assessment is.
That's much like the statutes, as I understand it now, Mr. Chair, that's LID, the LID for road improvements, that you could say your home is a mile down the road, therefore you will have one-fifth of this particular allocation. Mm-hmm. Your home is right next to the corner on this, therefore you'll have one-fiftieth of this proportion of the allocation. And then you just go down and determine what each of the various utilization aspects and the increase in value and increase in utilization and so forth. So in that regard, it's much like an LID, it sounds like, which is already in statute, I thought.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's true. There are some significant differences, however. With an LID, you need to have a special benefit that accrues to the property that is subject to the LID charge. And that is much more of a direct some benefit that you can link directly to particular parcels of property, like a sewer line, like a sidewalk, that sort of thing.
So there's no special benefit here, Mr. Chair.
This is a little bit more flexible than that. The words used actually require there to be a reasonable expectation of benefit from either the improvement or the services provided as a result of the improvement located in the district. So it's more flexible than this very narrow special benefit requirement for LIDs.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I understand, Dexter, so presumably if this were enacted and this were all vetted out, if Marion County, for instance, decided that up in the canyon in Gates and Mill City, where they have no enforcement, decided they wanted to do a special assessment up there to put a facility for law enforcement up there, and they determined this is what it would take and this is what it would cost, and went to those folks and said, do you want to pay for this with an assessment? And they presumably said yes, and all that. That's the kind of thing we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's correct.
And what do you do then when you have a policeman in Gates and you have an incident in Lyons and Lyons isn't paying for the Gates special assessment? Do they have limitations then? That would have to be vetted in way ahead of time, am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the standard is a reasonable expectation. That doesn't mean all benefits need to accrue to just the district. So that if a law enforcement incident happens outside the district, that's not a problem, an occasional one. If it's most of them outside the district, then perhaps there's a flaw in the plan.
Okay. I get it, I think.
Thank you. There are several more witnesses to be heard on this matter, I think. Thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation today. Now, as I understand it, just one last question. Is your view at this point that this bill is not quite ready for prime time?
Well, we're working with other parties, and I think you'll hear some concerns, too, from the cities that we've been working with. And so we'd like to keep working with the parties and see how far we can get and have the option, if the hour is not too late, to come back. But the clock is ticking, we do know.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have a list from earlier sessions, and I'm going to call it, and if you don't want to come, you don't have to. Andy Shaw, Tony Bieda.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. Andy Shaw with the League of Cities. We have a couple concerns, but first I wanted to say we generally support the idea. In fact, we were working on a bill on the Senate side that was attempting to establish city service districts that were similar in concept to this. They were looking at establishing a permanent rate levy in a limited area of a city, somewhat like a special district, but for a specified purpose. The city of Gresham sponsored that bill, and their effort was, as they're developing new communities, they aren't, with their permanent rate, able to support the level of services with parks and other amenities that they'd like to develop in those new regions. And that concept, we were supporting that concept on the Senate side. The bill didn't move out of committee given the time frames and when it was introduced. But so we are interested in seeing this concept move forward. We have a couple concerns. Those relate to, when a district like this overlaps a city's boundary, or if it's established in an entire county, obviously it overlaps the entire city, the role that a city has in the establishment of that district, the assessment that is created, and the potential compression of tax revenues that can be caused. As Mr. Johnson testified, this assessment would fall under the Measure 5 cap and would therefore be compressed if compression exists, or could create compression for regions that are near compression, which could cause the loss of revenues for other taxing districts. So we are working with the County of Clackamas to talk about and try to resolve those issues, and would also enjoy the opportunity to come back if we can come to some accommodation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Tony.
Good. Tony Bieda, Lane County Government. I'll be brief with my remarks. I did just have passed out to you a copy of the letter from our Lane County Sheriff. We have briefed our sheriff on the possibility of an assessment district. We've worked closely with Sheriff Russ Berger and all of the law enforcement community in Lane County to try to come up with some kind of funding mechanism beyond what currently exists to provide more sustainable and stable funding for public safety. In Lane County, as in most counties, the public safety function, we're talking, of course, sheriff's patrol, investigations, adult corrections, parole and probation, and the prosecution function eats up in excess of 80% of our county general fund. So of the $1.28 per thousand that we have on property taxes in Lane County, most of that goes to just provide those basic functions. And as you know, based on the property tax structure in Oregon, that revenue grows at maximum about 3% a year, and our embedded costs without adding a single service or additional deputy or corrections capacity grows at 5 to 6% a year. So it's unsustainable. You simply keep cutting services and programs just in order to deliver balanced budget every year. And of course, with the likely demise ultimately of federal timber receipts, which has been the big bolster to the insufficiency of property taxes, the circumstance just becomes more dire. So of course we're desperate to find new funding mechanisms that would allow us to really, with the citizens' participation at their behest, come forward with something like an assessment district. I think back to the question that was raised earlier by Representative Olson, in terms of the process and having some kind of buy-in by the citizens on the front end. What is contemplated in Lane County would be if we have a section of the county, an urbanized or unurbanized, unincorporated area that is simply dissatisfied with the level of patrol that they're receiving, and they come to the county and say, we want a higher level of public safety. This would be a mechanism we could offer to them. They would have to come to us, come to the county board and say, we want to explore this, we want to develop a plan, and we're prepared to go and socialize it with our neighbors if you're prepared to enact it. And if they do a good job on the front end of socializing it, hopefully it won't get referred. If they don't do a good job, it will get referred. So they have that possibility. It would just simply be another tool in the toolbox, and we think we need to have access to that to fortify some of our public safety capacity in the rural areas. Sheriff Berger in his letter mentions some of the ongoing public safety risks. It's not unique to Lane County, but even though the overall crime rate is flat, there are elements of the public safety situation in the upper Willamette Valley that just continue to get worse and worse. It's not really adding to a civil community. It's deteriorating that condition, and we just can't simply continue to ignore it. So I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? We have three more witnesses to be heard. Representative Olson. Representative Butler.
Thank you. I just wanted to confirm then that what you could do, if it was part of the plan in Lane County, if this bill were to pass with this -3 amendment, that you could actually set up a high crime corridor and say this is an area, industrial area, residential area that needs some special attention, and you could actually go outside of your police department, your sheriff's department, and say, fine, we'll just hire a private security firm and we'll contract with them to come and provide once a night inspections if necessary.
We haven't contemplated who would actually provide the service beyond the sheriff's office, but certainly that would have to be explored.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Tony, I guess I can think of a handful of places down there in Lane County that you'd want to maybe pursue something like this for.
Okay.
Cottage Grove, Oak Ridge, Elmira, I mean, everywhere. Let's just talk about Cottage Grove. What's your sense of how the voters would feel down there if you moved through with something like this down there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I think within the city limits of Cottage Grove, there would be less of an appetite.
Right.
I think outside of the urban growth boundary or the city limits, there would be a higher appetite if, in fact, it was directly linked to a discernible increase in patrol presence. Most of the conundrum that we face in terms of passing a countywide funding mechanism is that most of the benefit in that case in terms of additional patrol would accrue to the rural areas. Most of the votes to pass it are in the urban areas, and the urban residents simply feel like because they're paying for police patrol, they are paying for the entire public safety system, and of course it's very difficult to disabuse them of that notion.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. There are three others I have signed up who would like to be heard. Ralph Groner, Doris Penwell, and Russ Walker. If the three of you still want to be heard, please come forward. I don't see Mr. Groner.
Am I not?
I'm working from the sign-up list from
good.
Last
That's
time
fine.
And also this time. Please, go ahead.
Good, thank you. I'm Doris Penwell from the Association of Oregon Counties. I just wanted to say that, as you've heard from the testimony, we have a number of situations in a number of counties around the state where this might be some kind of a possibility we could use, and we really would like to explore with some of our partners how this sort of thing could work, whether we can do it now or later, but we need to do it fairly soon, just to be sure we're providing services to the same people that you represent as well. So thank you for listening to this testimony and considering it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Walker.
Thank you. My name is Russ Walker. For the record, I represent Freedom Works. We have about 30,000 members in the state of Oregon. I'm here today to testify against 3052. From our perspective as an organization and the people we represent, we see this as a means to sidestep ballot measure 50, as well as a means to provide for more tax revenue out of the pockets of Oregonians. It's clever to dedicate it to police and fire and other special services. I'm of course wonder where special districts are on this and why they're not here testifying in favor of 3052 if it's such a priority. I also am a little bit confused by a number of provisions inside of 3052. Not really sure whether or not it looks to me as if the assessments, the special assessment, can be made and imposed, and then it is up to the citizens then to refer it if they don't like it. And if I'm incorrect on that, please let me know. But that would seem to be a violation of the trust that voters have again and again reaffirmed here in the state of Oregon when it comes to how they want their taxes, local taxes, raised, especially in regards to Measure 50, when they've said that they do not want, they want to limit the increase of their property taxes. They already have a means by which to increase or fund special projects, and they do that through levies. And as we know from the last election cycle, the appetite of Oregonians is not real friendly towards additional levies. So I guess I'll just close my testimony by saying that we have a number of issues with this. Really, if cities and counties and special districts are concerned about funding, we really need to begin to prioritize what we spend money on as a state and as counties and cities. Eliminate things that are not do not address core functions, and focus our money and our efforts on providing for those things that citizens want most, which is, of course, the things that this bill will provide additional funding for. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for either of these two? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. I see that there are others who would like to be heard. Come forward. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 3052?
Chair Barnhart, committee, for the record, Bill Clute, Carpenters Industrial Council. I sit back there and listen to this. President Olson, you rattled off a list of cities. Chair, committee, there's been over 5,000 of my members lose their jobs in that area right there. Here we are importing half of our lumber into this state, and we're sitting on a gold mine of timber. If we could get our federal folks to get a federal forest policy in act, we could rebuild these cities. We could build the mills. We could put them 5,000 people back to work. And we wouldn't have to sit through hearings like this, trying to put a Band-Aid on an open wound. This is what's going to make Oregon work, is putting our people back to work at family-based jobs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Last chance. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3052.
I can pull it.
Drag it out, the first one.
Oh, yeah, 2752.
We'll open a work session on House Bill 2752. Let's see. Chris is on that one. Chris, tell us where we are on this one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2752 is the bill that extends the Working Family Child Care Credit to couples where one spouse is working and then the other is disabled to the point where they cannot provide the child care, so the family incurs child care expenses. You have before you a -6 amendment, which was the most recent version put forth by the sponsor to address some of the issues in earlier versions about making the applicability to the target group. The difference here is that with the -6, the Department of Revenue may require that the physician verify the existence of the disability and its severity, and then the Department of Revenue would provide a form for verification by the physician that the taxpayer would then submit. Earlier versions had the Department of Human Services defining disability and so forth. Here, with the dash 6, DHS is removed from the equation, so to speak, and it would be within the purview of the Department of Revenue to require proof of the disability.
Well, it'd become an auditing issue, in effect.
In effect.
Okay.
You also have in front of you, the committee discussed a sunset date for the working family credit. And you have before you a dash 5 and a dash 7. The dash 5 represents the sunset date the committee requested, which was January 1st, 2013. The only difference between the dash 5 and the dash 7 is the exact sunset date. Between the time that, the dash 5 was requested in my conversations with Ledge Council, they had expressed a preference to not sunset tax expenditures during a session, essentially in odd years. So they have offered up the dash 7, which moves the sunset to an even year. They want to avoid the situation of having a tax expenditure sunset during a legislative session. That's the motivation behind the two different dates there, the odd year and the even year.
Okay. Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, two things with regard to the Department of Revenue and this new physical or cognitive condition that results in a person requiring assistance with activities of daily living. That is a much broader definition than the current disability definition that we use within the meaning as administered for the Department of Revenue for the additional exemption requirement, isn't it?
Vice Chair Butler, you're referring to the severe disability?
Yes, sir.
I believe this is a subset of that because part of the severe disability refers to a loss of limbs and so forth, and that I don't know that that would necessarily prevent somebody from providing child care because they lost because of a loss of limbs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Elser.
Thank you. On that issue, the activities of daily living are very specific in terms of disability. There are things like feeding oneself, toileting oneself. If you need assistance with activities of daily living, you need someone that's caring for you in order to do that. I believe this actually more carefully narrows that definition of disability, so it's not just you're in a wheelchair. A person in a wheelchair could easily take care of a child, but a person that needs assistance breathing or a person that needs, you know, their own airway sectioned or a person that needs repositioning during the day, a person that needs to be fed, those are activities of daily living, and those might be the indicators that if you're not able to care for yourself, you probably are not able to care for your child either.
I agree. This is a very, very narrow definition, and it's the activities for daily living is a term of art which is regularly used in the medical profession and in the ancillary professions to describe exactly what Representative Gelser has indicated.
So this would be a more narrow definition than what the current, but it would still be administered by the Department of Revenue for the purposes of this credit only.
Right. Is that right?
Correct. Okay. And that would be where the proof from a physician would be that compliance aspect that the chair was referring to.
And I'm not familiar. Is that something that we typically do, Mr. Chair, if I may, to represent Gelser, is that something that a physician typically signs a form that says this person has a physical or cognitive condition which requires this person to have assistance for the daily activities to live?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, obviously they don't do that right now because we don't have this law for this specifically, but certainly physicians are in the place of writing these notes for things like wildlife permits or for parking permits. We have tax credits for IEPs where what you're stapling on the back is basically that assessment from the school. I believe, because I had a conversation with the sponsor, that the goal here was to make the documentation similar to what we do for a child with a disability, and it was also addressing one of the concerns that I had, which was not to imply that people with disabilities can't care for their children or can't be parents. Most of them can, but this narrows it. You can't just be a person with a disability to qualify for this credit. You have to be a person with a disability whose disability is so severe that you cannot care for yourself or your child. And a physician would be able to document that.
Physicians routinely document these kinds of things for a variety of tax purposes, including medical deduction for the cost of an assistant.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, then, the Department of Revenue, do they currently administer a program that requires a certificate by a physician and audit those?
I believe the department is here, so they might.
Are you able to comment on that question? Deborah?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to think of any program that we have that requires, in all cases, verification by a physician. I'm not aware of one. Representative Gelser did mention the disabled child, which does require certification of a plan. So that is a standard there. We would request from the taxpayer certification by a physician, for example, of a severely disabled taxpayer, if we thought that was necessary. So I don't see this as being very problematic for us to administer this particular provision. It would not, in all cases, be necessary to have a physician's verification, but we could ask for that if we thought it would be necessary to determine they were eligible for the credit.
And it might be the same certification that you'd require for some other tax purpose as well, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chairman, it
potentially could be.
It could be. And I'm trying to remember whether the federal credit for, and perhaps Representative Butler is more familiar with this than I am, but elderly and disabled credit on the federal, I believe, may require a physician's certification. And I think we also recognize a portion of that credit. So there's that standard already in place as well.
And the way I read this bill, if it were passed exactly as the Dash 6 are stated, you could require the certification to be sent along with the tax return. You could simply use this as a way of requiring a certification at audit.
Mr. Chairman, that is how I read that as well. It's permissive in that we may require that a physician verify it, but we are not required to, and we are not required to ask for a form to be filed with the return. So it may be that we want to do that as standard practice to just make taxpayers aware of it and make sure that they get the information when they're visiting their physician, but I see that as being permissive.
Thank you. I do as well. Other questions for Representative Berger?
Yes, this isn't for Deborah, this is for staff.
Yes.
I have no fiscal impact on here. Is there any way of measuring how many people would take advantage of this? And
the revenue impact should have been provided less. It's less than $50,000. I started with, on the tax return, there's the severe disability, a conditional personal exemption credit that Vice Chair Butler referred to. And focus, starting with that and then getting to the kind of winnowing it down to joint returns who are not claiming the working family credit that are under certain income levels, get down to a very small number of taxpayers, because presumably these taxpayers would be claiming that severe disability.
Okay. I have nothing in here, and I haven't seen anything, but thank you.
It's a less than $50,000.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Gelser.
I do think just it was... I really appreciate the work that the sponsor put into this bill, and we heard this bill in our Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee earlier. Representative Olson was there with me. This is a very narrow definition, and it actually would not apply to some of the individuals that testified to our Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee that came to support the bill, because they would not meet that activities of daily living requirement.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. I would also bring your attention, as Representative Butler just did to me, the email from Representative Holvey's office in which a proposed statement of purpose and proposed benchmarks are stated. And I would expect the committee would ask that those be incorporated in the staff measure summary and thus be transmitted to the department. If we were to pass this bill so that it could be included in the tax expenditure report.
And, Mr. Chair, in keeping with the rules of the committee,
yeah.
the dash 7 also then would provide a sunset so
Correct.
That we could have that opportunity to review.
Right. All of those things would, at that point, come together. I did have a short conversation concerning the benchmarks, and as I understand it, these are this information is already accumulated by the department, and it would simply be a matter of posting the results.
So, Mr. Chair, at this point, I take it from the conversation, less than a very few number of people. A form not required to be attached, and if it is required to be attached, it could be a copy of the form that the department could monitor from time to time or request an audit from time to time. The fiscal cost of the administration of this program would be minimal, less than $50,000 for requirement to ship this off to the Ways
yes.
and Means. Mr. Chair, we're in work session.
Yes.
I would move the dash 6 to Senate House Bill 2752, dated 5/29/07.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the dash 6 amendments. Discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the dash 6s are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 7 to House Bill 2752, dated 5/29/07, to go ahead and implement the sunset date of 2014.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the dash 7 amendments. Is there a discussion? I have one question. I want to make sure I understand. This dash 7 amendments sunsets the material, the items in the bill, but nothing else.
It's the entire credit.
It's the entire credit.
It's the entire
Glad
credit.
I asked the question.
Which is why in line 18 and 19, it also repeals the refund. That's a refundability aspect that has to do with the payments as opposed to just that language that's line 4 repeals the credit. 315-262 is the entire working family credit.
Okay.
And then lines 18 and 19 in section 4, that repeals the ability to refund the amount of the credit in excess of the taxpayer's liability, the refundable portion. So basically, the way the working family child credit works is the taxpayer claims the credit and their liability may be reduced down to zero. And if they still have some unused credit, then the department is allowed, then what the taxpayer gets is the amount of that credit. So they have a negative liability, if you will.
Oh, I follow. The repeal in line 17, 18, and 19 of the amendment goes into effect on January 1st, 2014.
Correct.
Okay, now I understand. It seems like an awkward way to do a sunset, but it works.
Yeah, there are kind of two pieces to it.
Yes, yes. So we sunset the statute and repeal the piece that allows for refundability on January 1, 2014. Therefore, if the legislature wanted to move the sunset or continue the bill, the law in effect, it would have to take some action before that date.
Correct.
All right.
And Mr. Chair, just to confirm, we've been handed the fiscal here, and there's less than $50,000 in any biennium is the total cost of the total cost of implementation of this tax credit program working family.
I would expect the N on this to be pretty small.
It is very small.
Yeah.
I in some of these I had put minimal on. And earlier in the session, I would have put a minimal on here. And the House floor, there have been some questions about what minimal means.
Yeah.
So it's a less than 50, but it's a lot less than 50.
Okay.
A lot less.
A lot less.
All right. We'll remember that, too. Whoever carries the bill will remember that.
And Mr. Chair, just a final item while we're in work session before we go to the bill itself.
Well, we're still on the dash 7, so on your motion on the dash 7.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Is there anything else on the dash 7s? Is there any objection to the dash 7s? All right, seeing none, the dash 7s are adopted.
Chair.
Representative Butler, you wanted to raise a different issue.
Different issue, and that is that we have dated May 30th in our file through Chair or through Legislative Revenue Officer Paul Warner, a letter from the author, Representative Holby, issuing the statement of purpose as well as the benchmarks, and there may be other benchmarks that I think that Legislative Revenue is capable of monitoring with the Department of Revenue because they will have the tax credit information. I think it would be important to know more than just the numbers of people whom this apply and the numbers of families that are involved, the actual benefit in terms of child care and returning those people to a self-sufficiency standpoint as much as possible within the family unit. That would be something that we'd have to work on as we went forward, that credit will be okay over time.
We've handled these so far on a fairly informal basis.
We have.
I don't mind making it more formal, but I think if the Legislative Revenue Office and also the Department understand where we're headed, if they come up with additional measures that ought to be included in the tax expenditure report, I don't think it would hurt any of our feelings if they did that. Is that the gist of what you're requesting?
Yes, sir.
Attorney Butler? Thank you.
I think the term in terms of numbers is just outputs.
Yes.
When we talk about how it affects families, to keep families together, keep families productive and working, and those kinds of things, those are outcomes. We're after outcomes, not just outputs.
That's true. And also, I would note that this is our first cut on these kinds of things. I expect them to get better as we go along, as time moves along. Committee, what's your pleasure on the bill as amended with the dash 6 and the dash 7 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelson.
I would move House Bill 2752 as amended to the floor with a few past recommendations.
Thank you. Representative Gelson moves House Bill 2752 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? I don't see any. Call the roll.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Butler?
Yes.
Representative
Walter?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative
Gelsenhaus?
Excused.
Representative
Witt?
Aye.
The bill, having received the required majority, is adopted and sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'm going to suggest that Representative Holby carry the bill. If he declines, then we'll raise the issue again. Otherwise, I'll ask Representative Holby. And with that, we've completed the business on that bill, 2752. We've closed the work session. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3331.
That's yours. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3331 creates a credit, a personal income tax credit for taxpayers who provide a living donation of one of their kidneys or a partial liver transplant in a transplant operation. The credit is the lesser of 50% of the taxpayer's liability or $1,000. It is non-refundable and may not be carried forward, and it requires the taxpayer to submit verifying documentation with their tax return. It applies to transplant operations occurring in tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2008 and before January 1, 2013. You also have a draft revenue impact statement in your packet that has it's about $50,000 a year cost, and that is based on some information from the Oregon Procurement and Transplantation Network. According to the data that I found there, about 90 of these kidney transplants occur every year, and making some assumptions about the income distribution of those taxpayers, the revenue impact is about $50,000 a year.
Great, thank you. Chris Chapman.
Hi. Hope I'm the right distance. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Chris Chapman. I live in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 3331, which would provide a tax credit to people who donate organs. I affectionately like to call my bill the Oregon Kidney Plan, or OKP for short. Early in 1999, I learned my friend Desiree had been diagnosed with kidney failure due to a birth defect and would be undergoing surgery to remove her kidneys. Soon after, she would start dialysis, which would continue until she died or received a kidney transplant. After months of paperwork, doctor's appointments, phone calls, scads of blood tests, I was approved and donated a kidney to Desiree. Additionally, because I was self-employed at the time, I needed to raise money to be able to afford taking 3 months off work. There are not a lot of resources available for people in situations like mine, and I would like to change that. A year and a half later, I began working here at the Capitol, and I tried to think of ways to make the journey easier for those who might be in similar situations. The idea I came up with was a tax credit. Since 2003, I've submitted a concept like this one in each session. I've since found out that several states have passed concepts like this. Other states, including Washington, who was the first to, Wisconsin. Other states, including Wisconsin, who was the first to pass such legislation, use a different methodology for calculating the credit. They allow a $10,000 deduction from gross income for expenses incurred. I have no objection to changing the way in which this credit is determined. My original purpose was to save donors the hassle of dealing with receipts and reimbursements. The real deal for me is to give them a credit. With my testimony, I have attached a copy of the Wisconsin Act, a financial aspect sheet showing similar legislation in other states, and 25 facts about organ donation and transplantation from the National Kidney Association. Item 19 of that last document reads, "The results are even better for kidneys transplanted from living donors. 1 year after surgery, 97.6% of these kidneys were still functioning well." 97.6%. This is clearly a life-altering procedure that works. People benefit greatly from being released from the requirements of dialysis. They can get back to the business of living, not just existing. Returning these now healthy folks to the workforce is how the state would make back the tax credit that 3331 creates. The Organ Donor Program 0506 annual report says there were 103 organ donors in 2006. While this may not be the most earth-shattering piece of legislation you consider this session, it could be of great importance to some ailing Oregonians. It could also be the bill that allows more people to donate, and that is my agenda with this bill. This bill does not benefit me personally in any way. My hope is that it will benefit and ease the way for countless other Oregonians. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I hope you'll give this bill your support. I'm happy to answer questions. Good bill should pass. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Chris?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
First of all, I just wanted to thank Chris for, again, working on this bill this session. I know it's something that you've been working on for a very, very long, long time, and it is a good bill. And just in terms of the 106 or the 103 organ donors in 2006, mm-hmm. does that number include both living donors and those who have donated even after they have deceased?
Thank you for the question. And Representative Gelser, to the best of my understanding, the figure that they use, and it's right here on the second page of their annual report, these are living donors. The cadaver donations are a whole separate accounting system, maybe?
Yeah.
A whole separate ballgame. This is only the living ones that we're talking about with the 103.
They ask for their credit from somebody else.
Correct. That's right. More immediately allowed to, I suspect. Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 3331?
No questions.
Representative Butler.
Chris Alamack, question to staff. Chris, in looking over some of the other states and what they do, would a $10,000, it looks like a number of states provide for a $10,000 organ donation tax deduction. That actually would put us more in line with other states and would actually make it more uniform. We have a fairly high state tax rate. Those people who would be paying the maximum rate, this would come out to be a $900 tax credit in effect. But it does bring us more in uniform line with other states. Would that?
I imagine the revenue impact would be roughly similar.
Okay.
Precisely for that point, because the $10,000 gets right around the $1,000. The $10,000 deduction is roughly on par with a $1,000 credit for the top end.
Right, $900 max, but you would probably use 8%, which would be
something like that. Right, a lot of folks wouldn't be able to use the entire deduction. And even with the, but that's true even of the credit, there are certain tax,
sure.
I imagine there are some donors who have no tax liability, so they wouldn't benefit from the credit. But those were,
yeah. Representative Berger?
Yeah, it was my understanding from Chris's testimony that a lot of these states, you have to submit, it isn't $10,000, it's up to $10,000, and you submit expense reports, was my understanding of how this worked.
Yeah.
And that it was her notion to forego all that and just give straight up. But the money then would be considerably less.
Mr. Chair, the reason for my inquiry would be if we gave a flat $10,000 deduction for anybody that was donating an ORIN, then that $10,000 would be the equivalent of what other states do without the requirement of any of the paperwork, but it would just be a flat $10,000, even if you were a working mother at home, a mother at home not gainfully employed outside of the home for wages, the family would still be entitled to a $10,000 deduction. There's no lost wages, but certainly there's some other costs that are related to that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the comments about the moms that are at home. Having been home at one point with a 5-year-old and 3 children under 3, I can tell you I never have had and never will have a harder, longer job.
But no W-2.
But
no CPAs.
No, but there was a lot of other stuff on my shoulder. So I had a conversation in the process of this with the organization that advocates organ donation. Mm-hmm. And their one concern, and I think probably one of the reasons that the other states require that documentation, is that there's a really strong sense in the culture of organ donation that it's an altruistic act. And so the advocacy organization wanted to be clear in this bill that it was clearly a reimbursement for expenses rather than appearing that someone was receiving a financial benefit in exchange for having donated an organ, which is not why anybody donates an organ. I'm not suggesting that at all. But I think that's probably why there is the requirement to demonstrate the expenses that are related to doing that, and probably why in the other states that deduction isn't just lost wages, but medical and travel expenses that are related to doing that, and probably caregiving expenses as well. So while I certainly would not have a problem providing greater assistance and reimbursement to these individuals, I think there probably is a value in, as burdensome as the documentation would be, I think the upside of the $1,000 is that it's something that we can do now, and that it is more simple for the taxpayers to be able to demonstrate.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3331 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 514.
Measure Senate Bill 514A establishes a property tax special assessment program for land subject to conservation easements. It will allow land currently subject to farm use or forest use to have a special assessment to be transferred to a conservation special assessment without paying additional tax. Under current law, if you own farmland or forest land that is specially assessed and you decided to, let's say, switch in order to dedicate some of your land to conservation, you would be subject to owing tax on that portion of the land that you decided to conserve. And that's part of current law. So it sort of deters people from making the switch when they would like to possibly set some of their land aside. Under this bill, the owner would be permitted to withdraw application. He would make an application to reclassify for the conservation easement. He could withdraw it within 30 days after applying for a change of classification. It requires a $250 application fee for the conservation easement, and the fees are credited to the county's general fund in which the specially assessed property is located.
Thank you very much. That's helpful. And I've got, it appears as though I have two panels to call. Bruce Taylor, and I'm going to butcher the name. I'm sorry, Mike. Mike Propes, and Gary Oxley. Gentlemen.
Thank you. My name is Bruce Taylor, here for Defenders of Wildlife in support of Senate Bill 514. First, want to thank the chair and Representative Berger and your colleague, Representative Rosenbaum, for co-sponsoring the bill originally here. We appreciate your support. Defenders of Wildlife has had a long history of working on conservation incentives for private landowners here in Oregon, dating back to the late 1990s. This particular bill actually had its origins in some 2001 legislation that, for the first time, the state of Oregon recognized conservation as a legitimate land use and made it state policy to encourage voluntary conservation on private lands. One of the more popular ways for private landowners to do that kind of conservation on a voluntary basis is a conservation easement. That's a voluntary legal agreement that allows the landowner to limit use of their property, usually to protect open space or wildlife habitat. Property remains in private ownership, and conservation values are permanently protected under terms that are developed together by the landowner and whoever it is that holds the easement. So a lot of interest in using that tool for conservation, but the barrier, as your staff has explained here, is for some landowners is the threat of losing the special tax treatment that they currently get under farm or forest deferral. It's not just the loss of that tax treatment, it's the potential penalties for falling out of that category as well. So there are some landowners who would like to put part of their land under conservation easements that simply can't take that risk. So a work group formed by the legislature in 2003 to work through some of these issues recommended this particular change in tax law back in 2003. It was a bill in 2005 that passed the Senate, died over here in the House without a hearing. Same basic bill back again here in 2007, passed the Senate unanimously a couple of weeks ago. The only real difference this time around from 2005 is a minor technical amendment that the Association of Oregon Counties requested to address the concern of some county assessors. Otherwise, we have worked very closely with the Department of Revenue and the Association of Counties and all the stakeholders in putting together this bill. It has a lot of support, particularly among land trusts, the local land trusts, including some of those in some of your districts that actually hold some of these conservation easements. So that's basically, it's a fairly simple little bill. It's a small but important, at least to some particular landowners, small but important change to support voluntary conservation efforts by willing private landowners, and we hope you will support it. We'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Mike Propes, Polk County Commissioner, and just to give a little bit more history, the original concept came from a pilot program between Marion County, Polk County, and Yamhill County, and I was involved with that pilot program, and it was actually a gentleman called Molinari, so it was referred to as the Molinari Plan, and he came to the three boards of commissioners with the idea of trying to do a wildlife program on private property with the idea that if you can do these type of plans with property owners that want to do it, that takes the burden off of more wildlife through enforcement. That we know we need some wildlife corridors, we need some of these type of issues, and he was kind of anti-enforcement, but he was real pro-wildlife, and was pro-private property rights. So it appeared he had a really good concept to us, the Board of Commissioners of the three counties. So we said, yes, we'd like to work with him on that concept. So we came up with this pilot program that only affected the three counties, and we put it, we came to the legislature, and that pilot program passed unanimous in both houses. So we had that pilot program in place for, it was actually two legislative sessions to see how it worked. And we were very pleased with it. In Polk County, we had, at that time it was well over 500 acres went into the program. And it worked pretty much exactly what this bill is doing, is if property went, was in farm deferral, it was limited just to the farm at that time, out of farm deferral and went into this, it was treated with the same deferral, but it went into a wildlife deferral. And property owners worked with the Department of Wildlife to put together a plan on their property, and when that plan was accepted, it went into the this wildlife deferral. And we actually, Mr. Molinari was nominated by the three boards of commissioners, Marion County, Polk County, and Yamhill County, for an award to the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and he received the highest honor that they give from the state department for his plan. And their department said that this was one of the best things they had ever seen for protecting wildlife in Oregon at that time. They were very impressed. For one thing, it was not costing the state any money. It was not forcing anyone to do anything. And it was not costing the counties anything, because it costs the exact same to go from the deferral from one to the other. Now, the only cost we could identify is it was costing the counties, our administrative fees, the assessment, and those things. So that's what we're proposing here in this change, is to plug that hole. And everybody's pretty well agreed that's a reasonable thing. So we think we've come up with a plan in Oregon that people on their private property can do wildlife enhancements on a voluntary basis and not cost government anything. So this is kind of the program that years ago was a pilot, and tweaks. This program is a little different, but we think it's better than the program we originally started with. This will work better statewide than what our pilot program was in Polk County. But that's why the pilot program was done. This was an idea. How can you change the pilot program to be better? And that's what this group put together, was a better program. So that's why we're supporting it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of the Nature Conservancy. I believe you have before you a letter of support for 514 from Nan Evans, the Government Relations Director of the Nature Conservancy. So to conserve time, I will just simply say that we believe 514 provides an additional tool to enhance and advance conservation in the state of Oregon, and we strongly recommend that you move 514 forward.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
What portion of this land must be used for wildlife, and what are the ascertainable standards for wildlife preservation protection? I've had some emails and some questions about that particular portion of it. Are we conserving the land for the benefit of the people to walk on it, or are we conserving the land and trying to protect wildlife in place?
That will depend on the nature of the individual easement, which is a legal agreement between the private landowner and whoever holds the easement. Some cases it's a local government, sometimes it's a land trust. Sometimes an easement is simply just prohibiting subdivision. Rarely do easements actually confer public access rights. Most private landowners are not that interested in providing public access. They're interested in protecting their land the way it is. But I think you hit on the point. It's basically protecting the land. The exact terms of that are negotiated between the landowner and whoever holds the easement. But in most cases, it would talk about things like prohibiting subdivision and whatever else the landowner might want to put in there.
Follow up if I'm
yes, please, Representative Butler.
This particular person says that as a result of this
Lincoln Land, Lincoln County Land Legacy Program, the donation of some very valuable land, making it strictly an irrevocable easement on behalf of the state of Oregon. As a result, our taxes increased and we lost our STFO. You know, somebody understands what STFO, I'm assuming.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I can't respond to that. I believe that Lincoln County Commissioners submitted testimony in support of this bill in the Senate, and that's about all the light I can shed on that.
Our tax, these people are indicating that they lost their STFO, and I don't know whether that's a special use, whether that it was in a forest use previously. And
small tract forest land.
Okay.
Small tract forest land.
ST?
Small tract forest land option. Did I get it right, Mr. Phillips? I did. Thank you. It's interesting to note that private parties as well as state bureaucrats can speak in acronyms which the rest of us don't understand. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, in reference to that email, Representative Butler, I think you may need to go back and ask them, because I understand this was voluntary, that no one forces you to enter into these contracts, that the idea here is not for the state or the county or anyone else to tell you, but if you as a landowner want to protect this land in the future, you voluntarily would enter into this, and then you would stay in the same tax.
And Mr. Chair, there's nothing to indicate this wasn't a voluntary arrangement. It's just that in the process of doing that, they lost that special forest use on the remaining portion of their land that was not donated and contributed, but was still subject to this easement. And in that process, and losing that, then losing the small tract, the forest land tract, then their taxes became higher. And I think that's what this bill does, is it merely says,
no,
wait a minute,
no,
if you lose your farm exemption, if you lose your forest exemption, and it even goes so far, as I understand it, to remove any taxes in arrears in that process. So if you have fee simple to the land, and you donate that for the purposes of this easement, then any taxes in arrears that are as a result of the fact that you have a special use valuation would then be forgiven at that particular point. It could be that you'd owe 4 years in arrears at that point. Now, you'd still owe the basic deferred use on the remaining portion that you kept or whatever the value would be, but it could be that you would be actually forgiving taxes in arrears. I doubt that ever happens with these kinds of things. These folks are typically, first of all, it's got to be fee simple land. You're not going to give it out from underneath the bank or other mortgage company. So it's got to be some sort of fee that you can give. And secondly, then, typically these folks will have paid their property taxes. All they're asking for is that they not lose their special use exemption, as I see it.
Okay. Would you treat that as a question and respond to
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, 514 would solve the problem that your constituent had.
Well, it actually would help the constituent who wrote that, if you were to engage in that practice in the future, if this bill is adopted. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that these folks who lost their special use valuation could come back and actually reapply for it under this bill. That they are now not used as a special forest use land tract option, whatever, STFO, but that they could come back and apply for it and receive the benefits in Lincoln County. Is that?
I can't speak to the acronyms, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, but that's certainly the intent of the bill, was to create a new special assessment category so we didn't have to deal with these kind of confusions.
I'm not sure we can answer that, because it's going to depend on if they're in deferral or not. If they've lost their deferral, I don't think they could come back under this bill.
Okay. Well, I was looking for that section, and I thought I had found it, but now I can't find it again.
They do have to make a special application, 30 days applying for the change in the application, and so I think Commissioner Probst is correct that there is a waiting period, and they pay a $250 fee to help your assessor's office go ahead and reclassify that on that one-time reclass, in effect.
Mary, can you point us to the section that talks about these texts? The problem with switching from one special assessment area to this conservation easement special assessment, because I did understand that the problem, one of the problems was that you could lose your farm deferral in the process of trying to gain this conservation easement special assessment and thereby be out tax money in the process. And one of the purposes of this bill, as I understood it, was to fix that.
That it would fix it, but if that's already happened to them prior to this,
if it's already happened beforehand, then this doesn't fix
this
that.
This doesn't fix right. that.
Okay. Could you point out to where it actually where it makes the change for the future?
It's been months since I've seen this.
Yes. Okay. That's because yeah. Bunches of this is simply operational.
Looks like section 7 on pages 3 and 4 probably address. Paper provides certification prescribed within 90 days following the close of the 3-year period.
The land supplement that becomes disqualified.
No, that's a different issue. Different issue. We're talking about moving it from one kind of special assessment to a different kind of special assessment without triggering the default, right. essentially.
Correct.
Yeah.
You need an amendment if you want to look into
it. Well, I don't want to take the time now to make certain that we got this figured out, but I think it would be useful, Mary, if you would see where you can find that in the bill and bring it to our attention as we proceed, since it was my understanding that was a piece of the purpose of it. As I look at sections 1 through 7, it's a fairly straightforward statement of how the application process works and how the...
Section 11?
That could be.
Notwithstanding that land may have been disposed of, there's additional costs described. Maybe not.
Well, actually, I think you're right, because if you go back to line 39 on page 7,
right.
It refers to the land being disqualified for a special assessment, and yet notwithstanding that disqualification, the taxes remain on the rolls and won't actually be creating a liability if, among other things, Section 4 of this Act related to conservation easement special assessment is applied. So I think that does deal with the issue, Representative Berger. Thank you.
Thank you.
Trouble with reading statutes like this is that you have to go through each subsection qualification and disqualification to make sure you've got it right.
And it's mind-numbing.
No, it's what we do, Representative Butler.
Well, you enjoy it. I just didn't go do a tax return.
Yeah. Well, that shows why you and I are in different professions, doesn't it? Thank you. Other questions for this panel? I'm sorry we've gotten sidetracked on this issue. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Phillips, did you want to be heard on this issue? And then we'll go to our next panel after that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I just was looking at the question that you were all pondering over, and I believe that the way the statutes are structured, this starting with Section 8, 9, 10, and 11 at a minimum, what we're doing is we're tapping into the various statutes that provide for the various kinds of special assessments, such as farm, forest, wildlife, et cetera. And in each one of them, there's a section that deals with what if the property is disqualified. in all those cases, it allows for certain conditions where if you're disqualified but you roll into a certain other program, then the disqualification doesn't become operable. And in this case, what you're finding in Section 7, 8, 9, 10, I believe in 11 at least, maybe some other ones, 12, etc., they're adding language about conservation easement as being one of those exceptions whereby the disqualification doesn't trigger.
Thank
so
you.
I think that's how that works, although I'm not the expert in this area. I think that's going to help you get there.
I think on page 11, Section 14, an owner of a disqualified conservation easement, especially under Section 7, except wildlife habitat area, may not apply for another special assessment under this section without satisfying the requirements of the earlier section.
I think one of the reasons why a bill like this gets so long is exactly the things you're talking about. Actually, the guts of the bill are on the first 3.5 pages.
Sure, that's precise.
And the rest of it are making these fixes in these other statutes all the way through.
I hope that's helpful.
And that is helpful. Thank you. Thank you very much. We have another panel, and I'd like to call them Richard Kreitzer, Monk Webb, Jim Welch.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee. I'm Richard Kreitzer. I'm the Marion County Assessor and Tax Collector. Please forgive me. I'm recovering from 4 weeks of bronchitis, so if I cough, it's unintended. I've been in touch with some other county assessors and the president of the Assessors Association, and we have some concerns with House Bill 514.
Actually, it's Senate Bill.
Senate Bill.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I'm
Thank
sorry.
You.
Yeah. And one thing right up front, I just wanted to make sure that you understand this is a new special assessment that's being proposed. And it's a little bit different than wildlife habitat, and somewhat in that that program is optional to participate in by determination of the county governing body. Okay. So from a policy standpoint, this bill allows property to qualify for special assessment without farming or forest purposes. This is a big policy shift from the original purpose of special assessment, the special assessment programs to encourage farming and forest activities. Even exempt programs are determined by current use. This bill may open the door to create an environment where more and more properties go into or continue special assessments, allowing non-productive land to receive a special assessed value. This is not the only value. This is not only the value off the tax roll, but money taken out of the local economy. This bill eliminates the need for farmers and foresters to purchase equipment, fertilizer, seed, labor, etc., from local businesses that would be purchased if the land is kept in production. As far as the back tax issue, I feel the conservation easement should not be part of the special assessment programs because, and I'm going to name four reasons why I feel that way. I have seen in some instances where property owners have been paid handsomely to write conservation easements, so there's a benefit that occurs right up front. Number two, in some cases, these easements do not change the current use of the property, as you've heard in prior testimony. Farming is allowed to continue, so the special assessment would automatically continue anyway on the farm portion of that. Number three, the special assessment laws encourage farmers and landowners to keep land in production, and this bill goes against those principles. And finally, conservation easements take place now. I have only three that are active at present. The restrictions are considered at the time the value is established for tax purposes. So if there's a conservation easement that says that you can't do anything, you can't farm it, can't take any wood products off of the property or anything, we take that into consideration and put a real low value on it like it's wasteland anyway. So they do get the value reduction by the limitation of the uses. If this is considered, I would suggest taking out all references to 170H and putting in requirements for the assessor to be able to monitor and determine qualifications and disqualifications. Assessors do not have access to income information filed with the Department of Revenue. So we wouldn't have any way of knowing what was taking place on the income side. I'm not in favor of having an outside agency, and in this case, it would be a number of individual holders making the determination of how a property is to be taxed. Just a couple notes on qualifications and disqualifications. Criteria for qualifications should stay the same as current law dictates. Value issues and tax issues are already addressed very specifically. As far as disqualification statutes, these are also specific as currently written. Just a note here, the holder is not a disinterested party in this case. The holder seems to have a conflict of interest or a potential conflict of interest. Another concern is how much time per year do these properties need to be open to the public, and that's in 170H4A. Some other questions relating to permitted uses allowed by a conservation easement are also of concern. For instance, who determines these permitted uses? Could perhaps an easement, just an example, could an easement allow for hunting rights? Could a fee be charged for hunting and this be the primary use of the property, have no farm or forest purposes, and still qualify for special assessment? So I'm here to encourage this committee not to pass this bill for the reasons and probably some others that I failed to mention. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Webb, and I didn't give you the correct first name, Mark. Thank you.
Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Mark Webb. I'm the Grant County Judge. And I would strongly encourage y'all to oppose Senate Bill 514A unless one of the provisions is added. Allow counties to opt out of treating land subject to conservation easements similar to farm and timber special uses or assessments. And if you don't allow counties to do this, require the state to reimburse the relevant landowners from state coffers. The difference between the lower specially assessed rate and the higher rate that the land would otherwise fall under. Now, I have a number of reasons for saying this, and you've got them up there. I'm just going to address two general ones here. First, the fact is this bill, at least for rural counties like Grant County, is not needed when it comes to wildlife. Our agricultural, our farming and ranching and timber industries there require, by and large tracts of land, relatively undeveloped. And their associated activities are, for the most part, among the most conducive to wildlife needs, habitat, and the like that there is. We don't need it for wildlife protection or enhancement, by and large. So we don't. There's no reason to pass Senate Bill 514A for that reason. Okay. It may be true in more urban areas where you want to set aside little tracts of ground because of heavy development, but not in the large rural counties. Secondly, and this is the main thing that I think concerns a county like Grant, the fact is Senate Bill 514A is not revenue neutral. It simply is not revenue neutral. If implemented, it will, certainly over long term, cost rural counties quite a bit of money, and I'll say this for two reasons. One is that farm and timber use special assessments were originally implemented to preserve farm and timber ground by giving farm and timber owners tax breaks so they could more easily make a living off their land. But associated with this tax break, and this is what I want to emphasize, associated with this tax break was and still is the expectation, the legal expectation, that they will attempt to make a profit off the land by working it and thereby contribute to the area's economy in ways that make up for lost tax revenues. That is to say, the special use assessments and tax breaks in question have important associated economic obligations which Senate Bill 514A clearly severs. It just cuts them. Okay? It will enable landowners with conservation easements to get substantial tax breaks without the associated obligations and work that have, in fact, preserved large natural spaces and rural landscapes in a manner that also contributes, to rural economies. Okay, a second one is that the phrase conservation easement, as it's currently defined, will apply to lands to virtually any size piece of property or any type of property, not quite all, but many, will apply to lands that are not subject to farm and timber special assessments. So, for example, any rural non-farm parcel, and I'm thinking, for example, of this situation, and I talk about it. My neighbor has a 180-acre piece. It's zoned multiple-use range. The minimum size parcel to get a farm or ranch tax deferral or special use assessment is a 160. He could peel 20 acres off of that. And that's what I'm talking about here. This is the non-farm parcel that has been created over the years, as well as those yet to be created, will, with a conservation easement, qualify for a special use assessment, which would significantly lower the property taxes on that piece of ground relative to what it would otherwise be assessed at. Okay?
Can I ask a question there, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bauer.
And Judge Webb, would it be then that they could build a home on that? And
yeah, they
still
could build a home on
that.
That
special use assessment on the 20 acres itself.
Well, it wouldn't be where the
residence
house
itself,
right.
But on the remaining portion of the 20 acres,
but in
would still
that,
qualify
right.
for that. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That will, and I know that proponents of Senate Bill 514A don't intend this, but in fact, the way it's written, it will, in fact, provide substantial financial incentive to subdivide high-priced farm and timber parcels because you're going to get a drastically reduced tax rate on that. It's very lucrative. And again, this is going to be at significant cost to the county. And I wished I had the numbers to give you. I mean, this is new, and I don't know how quite to project it, but I just want to refer you to, and I think you'll have it there, an article from The Economist. It's February 3rd. Titled Mountains for the Centuries, and they're talking about conservation easements in Colorado. It's a little bit different there. There's a tax income credit for people who take out conservation easements. So I just want to read the next to the last paragraph. The law seems to have few enemies, even conservatives like it. However, its cost and tax revenues is raising eyebrows. An annual review loss from the tax income credits rose from a mere $2.3 million in fiscal 2001 to $85.1 million in 2005. Conservation easements cost money. Counties like Grant County can't afford that kind of cost. And so if you're going to vote for Senate Bill 514A, I would encourage you to do it only if you allow counties to opt out or you require the state to pick up the cost to the counties and lost tax revenue. That seems to me a way to accommodate our concerns as well as the concerns of the people who went before us.
Thank you. The Cattleman.
Chair Barnhart, committee members, I'm Jim Welsh representing the Oregon Cattlemen Association. Mr. Chair, you've heard from the two technicians from local government, an assessor and a county judge. And I did not plan to sit between them, but I guarantee you I'm pleased that I did. And the cattlemen do support everything that they have said. And this has been our concern and haven't had a good explanation, but I sat here with you and gained that. We believe that beginning of a farm special farm assessments was based on good policy. But as this has been protracted over time, what you've heard today is a real living unintended consequence, I think. We addressed this in the 90s, but I don't think it was intended to remove revenues at the county level that you're starting to hear about. And the Oregon Cattlemen Association does not support that. We want to make sure that we pay our way through the general business that we do, because that's going to support our communities. And then to keep this ground in productivity makes a big difference as we pay our taxes for the property taxes and court's income that over a period of time for the state too. So it does make a difference at county and state level. And I'm just going to close it there and hope that you reconsider. And I think there's more work to be done on this if you're going to decide to pass it on or just let it lie here and die in this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Question, Representative Berger?
Yes. I guess I'm not quite sure. What you're saying the county loses is these properties that are now in these special assessments would then be changed to some other assessment if they didn't go into a conservation easement, and therefore you would lose this potential future tax revenue?
You lose revenue in two ways. One, as was mentioned, the tax breaks, farm and timber have associated obligations to work the land, make a profit, and so on. That involves our rural economies, our local workforce, and the like. Conservation easements don't similarly require the owner of the land to do anything like that. So the local economy is not invigorated in the same way that it is with farm and timber special use assessments. Secondly, it is true that simply going from, say, a farm or timber use special assessment to a conservation easement, you're going to have the same rate. So there's no loss in revenue there. That's correct. But there is the loss in revenue of the kind I just mentioned. It's not going to involve the local workforce, and it's not going to stimulate the economy because you're not working the land. And secondly, as it's currently written, there is land that now could not be subject to a farmer timber special use assessment, and it would be taxed at a substantially higher rate than it would if it were under a farm or timber special use assessment. Conservation easements in principle and in practice will apply to those pieces of ground, which means that we can't tax them at the rate which we are currently allowed to do by state law. That's where we will start to lose tax revenue. Does that make
sense? Mr. Chair, I can't think I see this. That particular loophole, did you offer any amendment to try and correct that?
I'm new to this. I just suggested, and I don't know what the proper procedure is, that you allow the counties to opt out of this, because at least in Grant County, and I think many of the eastern Oregon or more rural counties, we appreciate this. Or secondly, that if you don't think it's going to cost money, let the state step up to the plate and pay what it's going to cost. Those are the only two options I know.
Mr. Chair, have you had any conservation easements in Grant County?
There are some conservation easements, but they're also currently still working ranches or timber ground. As I recall, there are conservation easements that preclude future housing development and the like.
Representative Butler?
And this is a question for staff, but before I say that, let me, Judge Webb and I have something in common. He and I represent together Southeast. He represents all of Grant County. I represent Southeast Grant County and 1,088 precious souls out there. So thank you very much, Judge. My question is to staff, any way to find out what in the Colorado revenue forecast was back in 2001 relative to the granting of that revenue loss of $2.3 million and what it looked like to them for the next two biennia? I'm going to guess that they didn't have any idea that that was going to increase by 40-fold.
I can find out for you.
Because we certainly don't have that kind of revenue forecast here. We say that it stays fairly even at $26,000 in loss to local revenue per year, probably $56,000 per biennium.
Correct. Thank you. And I think that as we look at that, we ought to also review Internal Revenue Code Section 170 sub H.
Dealing with
that. I'd like to see a copy of that so we can have a sense of what it is we're talking about here. We can all look up ORS 271.715, which contains the definition of conservation easement, to help us understand what the definition is. I mean, the issues raised by these by this panel are serious issues. If they've misunderstood the bill, I'd like to know that. And if they haven't, I'd like to know that too, because you raised some very significant issues. And if they're in on point, then those would be significant issues for the bill. Other questions for this panel, Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this panel has the answer, but it would be helpful to me if anyone could help describe the lands that, at least to this point, have gone into conservation easements. In other words, is this prime ag and forestry land, or are we talking about marginal lands that maybe aren't one wouldn't consider to be prime production lands?
Chairman Barnhart, Representative Witt, I've got a copy of two of the easements that I have right here in front of me. And as I said before, they are very specific to the property. They do, in general, prohibit commercial use, cutting and removal of trees, erosion and other water pollution, alteration of land, that type of limitations. One here is a 4-page, and the other one is probably 25 pages. So it's just a matter of how these LLC land conservation corporate companies want to draw up the land, or what the owners would like to limit and under what circumstances. I have a property out on Vita Springs that is a wooded 3-acre home site that put a conservation easement on the property, not to be able to cut any trees and not to be able to develop that property. Zoned EFU, as of now, probably it's going to be not in my lifetime that they'd ever be able to develop that property into smaller units or anything anyway. So the conservation easement was there for their peace of mind, and I think, don't mark my words, but they probably got some financial benefit up front to put that conservation easement on the property. I had another one up just this side of Mahama that was a large property, probably 120 acres, and that was a combination of wetlands with a creek running through it, and part of it was designated as not being able to harvest anything off of it or touch it or alter it in any way, and the balance of it was just to keep the farming permitted uses as they are currently. So they vary depending on what type of properties you're talking about.
Other questions for this panel? Stay right there for a minute. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on this bill? What bill number? Senate Bill 514. Don wants to be heard. If you can hold it for a couple of minutes, that would be helpful. Come forward. I have another meeting at 3:00 that I have to get to today. Normally, I'd say we'd stick around. We also have another bill here, which I'm sorry to say we're not going to get to. And while I'm talking about it, SB 984, my plan at this moment is to hold it over till tomorrow, and I'd like it to be reflected in the agenda for tomorrow. If the witnesses who are here have problems with that, please let the staff know. Don, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Conservation easements have been around for a while, and the assessor and judge are very aware and very well spoken on the issue and appreciate their comments very much. Our concern when we started doing conservation easements was that they not be allowed to site a dwelling based on the conservation easement. I'm not sure, but I think in this bill that prohibition is continued in some new language there, if I read it correctly.
If I may, the definition of conservation easement is in the existing statute in ORS 271.715. I haven't actually read that, so I don't know whether it contains the same issue you're talking about or not.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think there's some new language in there that reiterates that for these provisions. We do have concerns about the bill. I would like to make just a couple comments about the farm use assessment. It's been referred to as a farm deferral. There isn't any such thing as farm deferral. It is, as the assessor indicated and the judge indicated, it's special assessment. There isn't any deferred taxes that you have to pay someday. What there is, and you referred to it also, is a tax penalty for change of use. That looks like a deferral because it's based on the difference between the taxes between what they would have been at market value and what they are under special assessments. And so it looks like a deferral, but it's not a deferral. It's a tax penalty for taking land out of farm use assessment. Farm use assessment came about in the early 60s because farmland was being assessed like residential property instead of being assessed as business property. While the judge used the term tax break, I would respectfully disagree with that term because it's using the income approach just like you do when you assess industrial or commercial property. You use the income approach to determine what the value of the land is.
Right.
So I just want to make those clarifications and express our concern about this bill.
Okay. Does the Farm Bureau have a position on the bill?
Not at this point.
Not at this point. Thank you. While people are still here, I'd like to simply say that this bill passed with a very high margin in the Senate. It appears to be a bipartisan vote in the Senate. It was worked by the Environment and Natural Resources Committee and then the Finance and Revenue Committee. This committee is not an expert in the substantive area that we're talking about here. We have not had the benefit of a House committee review of the substantive area. This is the Revenue Committee, and we're supposed to be making judgments on revenue. We're way afield of our area, at least as a committee of expertise. What I would like to do, since we don't have a lot of time left in the session, is to establish a small work group to study the bill and get back to us on it. I want to let both the proponents and the opponents know about that. I'm not certain at this point who I'm going to ask to work that from the legislature, but it probably will not be members of this committee. It will probably be members. There will probably be people who regularly work in the areas of natural resources and the environment. And I want to let you know that if you think you might like to be involved in that work group, be sure to leave your contact information with the Legislative Revenue Office staff so that the people who end up on the work group can get in touch with you. I would like to have a thorough understanding of the concerns raised by this second panel and also by the issues what the proponents of the bill hope to accomplish. The Senate passed the thing with a very large bipartisan vote, and on the one hand, the issues that you raise are very serious ones. On the other hand, I'd like to understand what the Senate missed, and if they didn't miss anything, then that's useful to know as well.
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Representative Butler.
May I just say one thing? That is, that in the process of passing this bill, we create a new page in the tax expenditure book too.
Thank you. That's also useful to remember. Appreciate that. Is there any question about the thing I've just said, or a different suggestion about how we might proceed, so we can quickly figure out whether this is a bill we ought to move ahead or not? Thank you. I appreciate that. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 514, and we are going to carry forward Senate Bill 984 to tomorrow, and the committee is adjourned. Thank you.